All right, so this evening we are going to spend most of our time in Genesis 37, but as a word of introduction, do me a favor, turn back with me to Genesis 15. Genesis 15. It's been a while since we were in Genesis 15, and so I just want to bring something into our recollection. So if you remember, in Genesis chapter 12, that was the beginning of the story of Abraham. God calls Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees. He makes him these promises of land, nation, name, and blessing. And then in Genesis chapter 15, it's a very, very important chapter, where God cuts a covenant with Abram at the time. Genesis 15:6, very important verse. Then Abram believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And at that time, we talked about justification, and we see that verse appearing in the New Testament multiple times. And then in verse 12 of Genesis 15, there is this covenant-cutting ceremony. And if you remember, there are these animals, and Abraham cuts the animals in two, and he sets them apart. And then in verse 12, Moses writes this: "Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him." Verse 13, "And God said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions.'" Verse 15, "And as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age." Verse 16, "Then in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." And then verse 17, following, there's this smoking torch then that is passing through these animal carcasses. Genesis 37 is the beginning, and this is what I want us to see, right, is God's faithfulness to this sort of backwards promise, if you will, right? So God has promised Abraham and his descendants the land that he's living on. But before that promise is fulfilled, Abraham's descendants will, verse 13, they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years, strangers in a land that is not theirs. And at that time, we took a few seconds just to think about 400 years. Okay, the United States is 240 years old, right? And we make a big deal in our high schools and college, right, American history. And it's very detailed, and there's a lot to be studied in American history. And it's only 240 years old. God is going to send Abraham's descendants to a land that is not theirs, which we will see today is Egypt. And they will be there 400, and technically we'll see as we finish up tonight, Lord willing, 430 years. Okay? Here in Genesis 15, 13, God says 400 years. This is not a discrepancy. This is God speaking in the way that we speak, right? 400 years, 430 years. At the end of the day, it's a less than 10% issue, okay? Right? But we will see that very clearly as we wrap up. The question that we will begin to answer tonight is, how do Abraham's descendants get to the land that is not theirs, such that they will ultimately be enslaved? That's what Genesis 37 is about. All right, so let's go over to Genesis 37. And let's begin now with the story of Joseph, all right? Jacob's son. Verse 1. "Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel," remember Israel is Jacob, Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a varicolored tunic, or a multicolored tunic. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And he said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brothers said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us?" Excuse me. So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now he had still another dream, and related it to his brothers, and said, "Lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And he related it to his father and to his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them." And he said to him, "I will go." Then he said to him, "Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "I am looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock." Then the man said, "They have moved from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. All right, so this is the first half of the chapter here as we're introduced to Joseph. Now, in verse 2, right at the beginning, it says, "These are the records of the generations of Jacob." So this is Moses hinting to us that a new part of the story is beginning. This phraseology appears multiple times in Genesis. We've already seen it. We saw it in Genesis chapter 6 with Noah. "These are the records of the generations of Noah." Right? And then most recently, we saw it back in Genesis 25. Moses writes, "Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac." All right? So now there's this new part of the story that's beginning. Joseph, now he's 17 years old. And it's interesting in verse 2, he's pasturing the flock with his brothers, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, right? And so, who are Joseph's brothers? But if you remember, Jacob had four wives, technically two wives and two concubines, right? And so his brothers, so Joseph's mother is Rachel, she's died, right? And so Joseph's brothers are the sons of Leah, right? Remember, Rachel and Leah are sisters. And then you have the two maids here, Bilhah and Zilpah, right? And so even Moses is drawing a distinction between Joseph and his brothers on the one hand, and then the sons of the maids on the other hand, all right? So there's clearly a distinction being made here. And then Joseph brings back this bad report about them to their father, right? I'm going to leave that for a second. So, verse 3, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age." So, here we see again, and we've already seen this before, this favoritism. If you remember, we've already seen this in Genesis. We saw it back in chapter 25, right? So, you had Isaac and Rebekah, and they had their favorites, right? Isaac, his favorite was Esau because he was a hunter, sort of a man's man, right? But Jacob was her favorite, right? Sort of a mother's boy, as it were. All right. And so now we have it again, the same sin of favoritism, and it basically is the root of everything that we're about to read for the next 14 chapters. And you see that at the end of verse 3, right? Israel makes for Joseph this multicolored tunic. Right, it's actually interesting because in the Hebrew it just says a tunic of that reaches down to his feet. In the Greek Septuagint, it actually it says multicolored. The point here is not necessarily the difference between those. The point here is that it is evidence of Israel or Jacob's favoritism towards Joseph, right? He buys him all the nicest clothes. They don't go down to the Salvation Army for Joseph, right? They go to Macy's or whatever, okay? All right, so his brothers saw, now verse 4, I want you to see something here. Verse 4, his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers. So apparently this was not something that was hidden from them. And then verse 4 ends with this, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Right? Now, in a different context, and it's been a while since we were in Romans 8, since Pastor Scott took so long getting through Romans 13, Romans 12, right? So it's been months now since we've been in Romans 8 in Sunday school. But one of the things that often we talk about in Romans 8 is we talk about the doctrine of total depravity. So in Romans 8, Paul says that those who are in the flesh cannot please God, right? They are not able to submit to God, right? And so oftentimes when we're talking about the doctrine of radical depravity, we will go here to Genesis 37, 4, right? And I want you to see that. So Joseph's brothers hated him and could not speak to him a kind word, right, or in peace, or on friendly terms. Is this a statement about Joseph's brother's physical ability to speak? No, it's not. Okay? It's not that Joseph's brothers were physically unable to speak to Joseph a kind word. It's that Joseph's brothers were spiritually unable to speak a kind word. They were literally unable to speak a kind word to Joseph. And why? Jealousy. Yeah, jealousy. They hate him. That's what it says, right? They hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Paul says the exact same thing in Romans chapter 8. Those who are in the flesh are at war with God and are unable to submit to him. Same exact issue. Okay? Those who are in the flesh hate God. And so it's not that they're somehow physically limited. It's that they're spiritually unable. All right? So even, again, as far back, and we've seen this over and over and over again in the book of Genesis, written fully 1,500 years before the New Testament, recounting to us things that were happening fully 2,000, 2,500 years before Jesus arrives on the scene. And yet, the theology here is completely consistent. All right? So Genesis 37:4, evidence of the radical depravity of mankind. Okay? So that's the first time that the text says they hated him. Right? Verse 5. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. Second time. Verse 8. Then his brothers said to him, are you actually going to reign over us, or are you really going to rule over us? So they hated him even more. What is the message that you think Moses is trying to get across to us here in the first few verses of Genesis 37? Joseph was hated by his brothers. And as we talk about over the next however many weeks it takes us to finish out Genesis, right? We will begin to see very clearly the parallels between Joseph and Jesus. Mm-hmm. And one of the parallels between Joseph and Jesus is that they were both hated by their brothers. Joseph, specifically in Genesis 37, by his half-brothers. Jesus, John chapter 1, he came to his own, and you finish it. His own did not receive him. Okay? And again, we're going to be drawing these parallels out. They should become abundantly obvious to you, even all the way through Genesis chapter 50. Okay? So Joseph has these two dreams. We've seen God using dreams, you know, as you read through the Old Testament here and there, visions. God appears to Noah. God appears to Abraham. Here, God uses dreams in Joseph's life in a powerful way. And this is the first set of dreams. And we will see that when Joseph's in Egypt, there will be another set of dreams as well. Actually, two sets of dreams that Joseph will weigh in on. These dreams were specifically given to Joseph. And so the first one, you have these binding sheaves in the field. And the 11 sheaves bow down to Joseph's sheaf. And then you have the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowing down to Joseph's star, right? And so Jacob, I might do that oftentimes. Jacob, he even rebukes him, verse 10, right? So Jacob doesn't really understand what's going on. His brothers discern that these dreams, Joseph is getting some sort of word. They assume that it's from Joseph's own mind, that he's going to rule over them someday. And again, adding to their hatred and jealousy, as Donna said, verse 11, his brothers were jealous of him. And verse 11 also says, his father Jacob kept this saying in mind. Does that remind anybody of anything? I don't know whether it's related or not, but it struck me as something that the Gospel of Luke says a couple of times, where Mary, the mother of Jesus, treasured up all these things in her heart. Right, as people were coming into the temple, Simeon comes into the temple and he holds up Jesus, right? And Mary doesn't really completely understand what's going on yet, but she treasures these things up in her heart for a future time, right? And so it just struck me there, for example, in Luke chapter 2, verse 19, similar language. So verse 12 begins a new paragraph. His brothers now, they go out to pasture the flock at Shechem, and Israel then sends Joseph out, right? And remember, the last time he sent Joseph out, verse 2, Joseph brought back a bad report about his brothers to their father, right? And so this is setting up the stage now so that when Joseph goes out to his brothers, he thinks they're in Shechem, right? So he's moving north in Canaan, right, out of Hebron into Shechem, where he thinks his brothers are pasturing the flock. Shechem, we've talked about in the past. That was Genesis 34 and the rape of Dinah, right? But they disappear out of Shechem, and they're headed further north into Dothan, all right? And so Joseph is following them around. Verse 15, he's wandering in the field, and then he finds them in Dothan. And so he begins to approach now his brothers who are pasturing the flock. Now, I want to go back to this bad report, and then the two dreams, right? And so there's a lot of speculation about Joseph's motivation for telling his brothers his dreams, right? Not all the commentators are agreed on this, right? So it's very easy for us to read verse 2. Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father, and then read the narratives about the dreams, and for us to assume that Joseph is a bit of a spoiled brat. Okay? I mean, that's the easiest way to read it. That's the way I read it, okay? Not everyone sees Joseph as that. Okay? Especially if you see Joseph, if the commentary or the commentator sees in Joseph a prefigurement of Christ. Mm-hmm. Okay? And part of the reason why they want to give Joseph the benefit of the doubt here, in addition to the fact that Joseph being a type of Christ, is that, as we will see when we get into the later chapters of Genesis, we cannot find any other evidence in Joseph's life of his unrighteousness. Okay. Now, I'm not saying, and the commentaries are not saying, that Joseph was a sinless man, right? But if you think about, right, we've all read through Genesis at least once, so we know about Joseph, you know, and Potiphar's wife, for example, right? She makes a pass at him, she comes on to him, and Joseph wants nothing of it. He does exactly what Paul would tell us to do, which is flee sexual immorality, right? He runs, even though it costs him another several years in jail, right? And so we don't have a lot of evidence in the rest of the story, even under a tremendous amount of persecution, right, and being wronged, we don't have evidence of Joseph being unrighteous, right? And so as you read, you know, if you go off and read the commentaries, you will see that not everyone's agreed on whether or not Joseph is actually being a spoiled brat here, just FYI. It is easy to read it that way, but it's not clear. All right. It may very well be, and we know, by the way, from Genesis 34 and Genesis 35, and Reuben's already slept with, you know, one of Jacob's concubines. The bottom line was, it's not hard for us to you know, think about bringing a bad report about Joseph's brothers. I told you I would do it, right? Joseph's brothers. It's not hard for us to see that, right? Moses is in fact giving us a bad report about Joseph's brothers. All right? So, just that's that. All right, so if we pick up in verse 18, so Joseph is now following his brothers to Dothan. When they saw him, that is, his brothers, saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say, a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, "Let us not take his life." Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." So it came about, when Joseph reached his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the vari-colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty, without any water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal, and as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the vari-colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not." Then he examined it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. All right. So the hatred of Joseph by Joseph's brothers, we see it runs very, very deep here, right? Very deep. I mean, it's almost unfathomable that his brothers would go to such great lengths, right, against Joseph. I mean, look at, even as we finish up the chapter, I mean, either they had no forethought, or they had the forethought and didn't care. The fact that they knew, if they would have thought about it, they would have known how Jacob would have responded to this. It's already very clear from the earliest parts of the chapter that Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons. right? He's the favorite son, right? And so, again, either they didn't think about it or they thought about it and didn't care that this was going to absolutely devastate their father. All right? And we see that it does. He refuses. He cannot be comforted. We read there in verse 35. So it's very, very tragic, very sad. So they plot, verse 18, against him to put him to death. Here comes this dreamer, right? So here's this jealousy, here's this hatred, right? This sarcasm coming out in verse 19. Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him. Okay? Then let us see what will become of his dreams. Right? Of course, God in his sovereignty, his plans will not be thwarted. And so what happens? What happens is in verse 21, Reuben, the firstborn in a sense, comes and rescues the youngest son. Right? Reuben, who's already a screw up, right? He's already slept with his father's concubine, right? But he is the oldest, and so in some sense, he has responsibility, right? He's taking responsibility here. And it says very clearly in verse 22, Reuben's intention was to rescue Joseph out of their hands to restore him to his father, okay? And so he's basically just trying to put them off as they're conspiring to kill Joseph, all right? So they want to throw him in the pit, and Reuben's basically going to steal him out of the pit and get him home and save his life, right? So Joseph shows up, verse 23, and they strip him of his clothes, right? And again, so much of the imagery of the Gospels comes through here, right? As I mentioned last week, or the last time we were together, and I don't know if it was on the recording or not, right? I pointed out that the New Testament writers do not pick up Joseph clearly as a type, right? Mm-hmm. But as Pastor Mike pointed out, and so many commentators have pointed out, and we will point out here, right, the parallels are uncanny, right? And so you can see here, verse 23, Joseph, the favored son of Israel, is stripped. Stripped. Okay. Pastor Mike was just preaching Sunday morning, right, from John 19, referring back to Psalm 22. What were the guards doing?
Casting lots for his clothes.
Casting lots for his clothes. Okay. Except for not his tunic, mm-hmm. which was of one piece. Right. So they take him, verse 24, they throw him into the pit. Pit was empty, right? So then they sit down to eat a meal, right? So they're plotting their brother's death and decide they're hungry. And so they sit and eat a meal. So they raise their eyes. They see these Ishmaelites, later also referred to as Midianites there in verse 28. These are the same people, right? What is significant, right, about the Ishmaelites and the Midianites? How do we know they're the same people? Who are they descended from? Yeah, they're all descended from Abraham and Ishmael, right? Right. So they're Ishmaelites because they're descended from Ishmael, and they're Midianites because they live south in Midian, okay? Right. And so I just read, you know, if you read these books by the skeptics, and they say, see, was it Ishmaelites or Midianites? And you think, well, Moses isn't a fool, right? And Moses is telling you these are the same people. They're all descendants of Abraham and Ishmael, right? Ishmaelites speaks of their descendants from whom they are descended, and Midianites speaks of where they're from, okay? Not that big of a deal, all right? So here they come, and they're coming from Gilead. So Gilead is on the east side of the Jordan River. So they're passing across the Jordan River. They're passing across the Jordan River, right? And they're taking the main road that runs west through Canaan and down into Egypt. That's where they're headed. Why? Because that's where they live. Okay? And they're traders. That's the direction in which they live. They're traders, right? That's what they're doing. So they're headed west into Canaan and then down toward Egypt. And you can see that. They're bearing gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Okay, verse 26, Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him." Right? For he is our brother, our own flesh. So there's a sense in which Reuben is intending to save Joseph's life. And there's a sense in which, in kind of a backwards way, Judah is also now stepping in to preserve Joseph's life, right? So he's our brother. Let's not kill him, unless you think that he's being sort of, you know, righteous in some way. He just wants to sell him and send him out of the country. All right? And so that's what they do. And so they sell him in verse 28, the Midianite traders passing by, right? They sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. All right. Then I want to fast forward down to verse 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt. So he gets sold twice for profit. Again, the parallels to Jesus. What's the parallel to Jesus? Jesus himself was sold.
Jesus.
For what?
30
pieces of silver. By one of his closest disciples. Right?
Almost the same name.
Almost, right, almost the same name, right? Judah. Mm-hmm. Okay? So Reuben comes back to the pit, verse 29. Joseph's not there. Reuben flips out. Right? Tears his garments. He doesn't know what he's going to do now. Verse 30, where am I to go? How can I go back to my father? We will see this motif again later in Egypt in a few chapters. How can I go back to my father and tell him that I'm not bringing his favorite son with me? Verse 31 is very interesting. So the brothers, after they've sold him and he's gone with the Ishmaelites, they took Joseph's tunic. They slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in blood. So there's multiple layers going on here. So the first layer is clearly a layer of deceit, right? So it's not hard for us to think back to the time when Jacob steals Esau's blessing. And he does it very clearly by way of deceit, right? So Jacob deceives his father, and now Jacob's sons are off to deceive him. How? They do it with clothing and a dead animal. Does that ring a bell? When Jacob deceived Isaac, Jacob was trying to convince Isaac that he was who? Esau. How did he do it? Two ways. The first way was he brought him a meal. A meal. He brought him a dead animal. What was the second way he deceived him?
Hairy. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. He took Esau's clothes, and he used the fur from the animal and put it on his arms and on his neck. So, in a sense, Jacob deceived Isaac with a dead animal and clothes. And now Jacob's sons are going to deceive their father with a dead animal and clothes. Okay? And so we see the sins of the father now being passed down to the sons, which we have seen again and again and again in the Genesis narrative. We see it in our own culture, right? It's very hard to break these types of cycles, right? Very interesting. Verse 32, they bring this tunic to their father. They lie. We found this. Is this Joseph's? Like they don't know. Jacob looks at it, verse 33, confirms Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. So Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. Verse 35, all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he wept because his favorite son is dead. Verse 36, as we saw previously, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So thus now begins, actually verse 28, they brought Joseph in to Egypt. And so as I said at the beginning, Genesis 15 now, what's becoming clear in the narrative is that that land that is not theirs, the land in which Abram, your descendants, will be strangers and they will be enslaved, we now find out that that land to which God was referring was Egypt. And so thus begins now the fulfillment of the word that God spoke to Abram 400 years. And so the rest of Genesis, okay, so now Joseph is there, but remember, Israel's not there yet. The rest of Genesis gives us the narrative of how Israel, the man, and the 12 tribes get to Egypt. Okay, so go with me now to the end of Genesis, Genesis 50. Genesis 50 ends, beginning in verse 22, with the death of Joseph. Now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household. So now the entire family, 70 plus persons, depending on who you count. If you go to Acts chapter 7, Stephen says it's 75, right? So there are a couple of different ways you can count that, but it's somewhere between 70 and 75 people make this trek down into Egypt, right? Because now they're coming to live with Joseph, who ends up being the vice president of Egypt, and we'll see how he gets there. And then there's this massive time span between Genesis 50, verse 26, and Exodus chapter 1, verse 1. And then if you go with me over to Exodus 12, Exodus 12, if I pick up in verse 33. So this is after now the 10 plagues. I'm not giving anything away, am I? Okay, there's 10 plagues that happen, okay? Spoiler alert. There's plagues. And the Egyptians urged the people to send the Israelites out of the land in haste, for they said, "We shall all be dead." So the people took their dough before it was leavened, with their kneading bowls bound up and the clothes on their shoulders. Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Does that sound familiar? Genesis 15, verse 14, God speaking to Abraham, "But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions." Let's keep reading. Exodus 12. Now the verse 37. Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children, and a mixed multitude also went up with them. Right, and I want to stay there, but I won't. Along with flocks and herds, a very large number of livestock. And they baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. Verse 40, now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came about at the end of 430 years to the very day that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. That's the end of the story prophesied in Genesis chapter 15. Genesis 37 begins the fulfillment of that promise, and Exodus 12, 40 and 41 ends the fulfillment of that promise. All right? So the next 20-some chapters is literally all about God's faithfulness to Abram and the promises he made in Genesis chapter 15 about Abram's descendants living as strangers in a land that is not their own. And then the remainder of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and Joshua is the fulfillment of the second part of that promise that God made to Abram, which is they are now going to go in and take possession of the land that God promised to him. The first six books of the Bible are essentially, mostly, about God's faithfulness to Abraham and the promises he made. And again, as we've said many times here, almost exclusively focused on one man, his 12 sons, and their descendants. Okay. And God will make a covenant with that nation in Exodus 20 through 24. Right. So we may get there someday. That's the plan. We're on our way there. Right. Genesis 37. Pastor Mike?